This week on Writers, Inc.
You know, the only voice I think I want to listen to when I'm writing is my own. I know at heart when a book is working or not. And yeah, occasionally I'll talk to my wife, Jill Green, but that's different because she is my producer. You know, I work for her, she pays my salary.
J.K. Rowling was nearly homeless when she wrote the first Harry Potter book. Stephen King penned Carrie in a small desk wedged between a washer and dryer. James Patterson worked in advertising and famously crafted the Toys R Us theme song long before becoming an author. Join New York Times bestseller J.D. Barker and a panel of industry powerhouses as they pull back the curtain on some of the world's most prolific authors. Where did they start? What is their process? The biggest names in publishing all have origin stories. All have tips and secrets. What does it take to consistently top the bestseller lists and become a household name? Get your notepad out. School's in session. This is Writers, Inc.
Hi, it's Christine Daigle.
I'm Dick Wybrow.
I'm Jenna Brown.
I'm Kevin Tomlinson.
And JD is not here this week. Welcome to Writers, Inc.
I'm annoyed that JD's out this week.
Oh, you know, no one actually deserves to be more annoyed that JD's not here than Christine, because today is her birthday.
Oh, it is her birthday.
Happy birthday.
Happy birthday to me.
Happy birthday. I took everything I had not to text you happy birthday today, because I was like, no, I want to say it on the show.
I confess that I did not know that it was your birthday. Christine,
now you know
I'm
it's
sorry.
My birthday.
All right, Kevin, you're just a man.
I got you nothing. I didn't get you a single thing.
That's fine. I am annoyed, though, that JD's not here to discuss Princess Bride.
I wanted to have that discussion as well. I can't believe he...
No,
he
was dead flat through
Kevin,
the whole thing.
Look at you.
I think he hated it. We'll let the table that for next time.
But he announced he was reading Ender's Game, so I wore my Ender's Game t-shirt to rah-rah him on. And then he
not
ditched
here.
Out on us.
I can't wait for that. We'll have to see what else from our childhood we can find for JD to crap all over.
You know, it's so interesting. Like the things that you watch, you know, when you're younger, and it has like such an impact. Like, I cannot imagine not enjoying The Princess Bride. I think JD is the first person I've ever met who didn't like that movie, but he's also probably the first person I've met who waited until well in adulthood to watch it. So.
Yeah.
Did he read the book first and then see the movie? Because I can see where somebody might, anytime you read the book, you're like,
it'll never be as good as the book I read.
And
I don't think so.
Some of those book
first
people.
He had no
people,
knowledge
no?
of it. Yeah.
Oh,
he wanted to know where the explosions were going to be. And I'm like, no.
They're inside.
Inside.
Right.
Yeah.
So we'll have to see what he thinks.
I could see where that movie would be lost on JD. I could see it. That's fine. That's fine.
I can't see it would be lost on anybody. It's very, very funny. I love
it. It's very funny.
It's great.
It's all right. Christine had a nice time, and that's all that matters.
I did have a nice time.
Yeah. You want to talk about the whole event, how it went?
Yeah. Well, it was JD's event. So he's not here, and I am. Yeah. He had the book launch for Something I Keep Upstairs, which came out May 13th on Wood Island in Maine.
How haunted was the
boat out there?
Scale of 1 to 10.
There were ghost hunters there, and they said they picked some stuff up.
Ooh,
so,
I bet they did.
Like what? Like dirt
on
or
their
like
shoe?
No, I don't know. They said they might have some voices. They were going to clean it up. So, paranormal podcast. You can go check them out.
Those voices are going to be saying, "Why isn't Kevin here?" That's what the spirits from beyond.
Yeah.
You always have to laugh with those shows, because that's one of their favorite things to do. They go through an entire place and they see nothing. They see nothing on camera. There's no movement whatsoever. Let's go to the tape. And there's always something on the tape.
Something.
And it's like, I think that's a commercial for Kmart. You're getting AM radio. That's what you're getting in
that's
there.
What it
that's
is.
There's nothing.
I'm going to
no
confess,
that I mean, house.
Just to make some of the listeners who are believers feel comfortable. I mean, I do believe in a spiritual realm out there. And
weren't you a ghost hunter? You did a ghost hunter thing for.
I've done some ghost hunting. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Well, if there was anywhere to find ghosts, that would have been the place. I mean, it's renovated now, so it looks beautiful.
How did it hold up to the description in the book?
Very, it was very accurate. Yeah. And they found two dead bodies there. Right outside.
Not
the,
that weekend. Not that trip.
No, but,
that's a party. That's a party, man.
And that's where they used to ship all the people for yellow fever. So there are a lot of deceased people hanging around that island.
Yeah, I'm sad that I missed out on the whole event. I'm not sad that I missed out on the haunted island experience. I wasn't.
Really? That's like the best part of the whole thing.
No, the
I don't
best part
know.
of the whole thing was I got to walk JD's duck on a leash. That was
Yeah, I
my
was going
highlight.
to say the
That
duck
was
on a leash was probably the best thing, but second best thing would definitely be the Haunted
That's
Island.
it.
Does he own? I'm sorry, this is new to me. He owns a duck,
Four ducks.
or wait,
I think they're technically his
oh,
wife's ducks, but he has four ducks.
right,
And I got to
yeah.
walk the black duck, who was
Wow, that's nuts.
okay-ish about it. Okay-ish about being in the leash.
Yeah.
Apparently, his daughter
We'll just
walked it.
say everyone was surprised that there was a duck on the leash, including the duck.
Yeah.
Including the duck. Yeah. The duck,
Wow.
what is this?
That's
Oh.
amazing. All right. Well, we should probably get to we should get to the news.
What's in the news this week, Kevin?
First up is the next great American novel being published on Substack. Substack is becoming a test kitchen for long-form fiction. Established authors such as Sherman Alexie, Chuck Palahniuk, Edgar Caret, and emerging writers alike are serializing novels, novellas, and nonfiction fiction directly to inboxes, giving them instant feedback and some subscription income before chasing a traditional deal. One breakout example is Naomi Kanakia's Money Matters. The 15,000-word novella was emailed to her list after publishers balked at its voice. Readers raved, and critics say it outsparked much official fiction. It shows how the platform can reward riskier styles that gatekeepers often smooth out. Substack may offer a new pipeline from inbox to bookstore. John Pistelli serialized the 700-page novel Major Arcana on Substack, self-published it on Kindle, then landed a print edition with an indie publisher after other Substackers championed the book, a model that bypasses the usual years-long submission slog. The takeaway for authors, Substack isn't just for essays. It can function as a workshop, fan-building tool, and even a shortcut to traditional publication.
Now,
I have
Kevin,
published a novella on Substack.
I was wondering about that. You're the Substack guy, so I don't know
Yeah.
who else has a Substack. I do
Love me
not.
some Substack. And I did, I think that novella did well. I actually put it behind the paywall. I think if I were to do it again, I would do it out in the open for the free subscribers. And do what these folks are doing. And I may go ahead and do that now that I see that it's, all the rage. I
So
tend to do more essay style stuff. Is
is
that
this
big?
saying that, because you said you've done this already, but is this article pointing to this idea of doing it for free or for subscription
It's a
or
good
what you're
question.
doing?
I think Chuck Palahniuk does it under the paywall. I don't he has both. Like obviously you have like your free things, but I think that his really good stuff is behind the paywall.
So all the unedited stuff.
Which makes sense. And that's what, when I did it, I actually was sort of live writing this thing where each week I would write a new chapter and post it like right then and there, right on the platform, no real editing. And it's nerve-wracking because writing out on the wire like that, all your mistakes are right there for people to see and ridicule and criticize over. So.
I think from a reader point of view, though, maybe this is something that's sort of like how writing has changed and how some of the, in some ways, indies, a lot of cases, are sort of ahead of some of the trad publishers. It's because a lot of indies have embraced this kind of model where you're sort of reaching out to readers every week, like with newsletters. I do a newsletter every week. Substack, it's just sort of, it's not quite a constant contact thing, but it's something where it's like, hey, listen, we have a relationship we're building, and that is something that's brought a lot of people's success. So in 2025, I think that this idea, this model of consistently being a force in a reader's life is a great place to be if you're providing content. It's great.
One question I want to investigate. I'll look closer at this after the show, but I want to know, are they, because I think they mentioned serialization a little, I think, if I remember, but I want to know what's more effective, because when I did my serialized novella, people complained because they didn't want to have to read something piecemeal. They wanted to be able to read it all at one time. So I don't know what's better.
I think, it's interesting that a lot of these things are happening. I do worry that like the new writers are like, oh, then this is the way to go. I think like traditional publishing will always scoop up the people who are successful. Like that's always sort of there. And I think that's kind of the end game for a lot of people is, hopefully that they can get something that has enough momentum that they can then get into that mainstream space. But, I think it's also important just to like know your own temperament as a writer. Like serialization is not for everyone. Live writing's not for everyone. Kind of keeping up with the pressure of like maintaining a Substack or a newsletter isn't necessarily for everyone. And there's a lot of writers out there, both indie and traditional, who, don't necessarily do all of those things. So find, it's fun to experiment and to try different things, but it's also okay to be like, that's just not
Those
for me.
experiments will also stretch you a little and teach you like what works for you, what doesn't. And I mean, I went through an exercise several years ago, well before Substack, where I wrote a short story a day for 30 days, and it went over great to the readers, but by the time it was done, I knew what I definitely did not want to be doing anymore.
Yeah,
Well, I
exactly.
think I'm the only one who's done serial, and I did that for at least 2 years. It might have been three, which was 2 to 4 chapters a week. And then I was just done. I was so burned out by the end of it. It's not for the faint of heart. So much respect to those who make that a career.
Are you writing that like, because I would think that sort of some serial writing, because you're sort of writing a bit of an arc each time, so there's at least some satisfaction. Yeah, exactly.
Well, it started out that way. Like we kind of did it season. So if you think of TV season, so season one was very structured. Season two was sort of structured, and three, and then four and five and six were just pants,
Scattershot.
just out of the pants.
You did that on Kindle Vella, right?
Yeah, on Kindle Vella.
Yeah. And then Amazon killed that, which I think technically makes Amazon a serial killer.
There you
All
go.
right, moving on to the
That's a good
next
joke.
story.
But I'm touched.
To avoid book order scams and fake reviews. Bulk order bait and switch is back. Fake publishing services tell authors that 3 to 5,000 copies of their book have been pre-ordered by chains and libraries, but the author must first wire thousands of dollars for printing or freight, in quotes. No books are ever shipped, royalties never appear, and the hustlers keep upselling new phantom services. Here are the red flags. Bookstore claims come from a self-publishing vendor, not the store. You're asked for upfront funds. No royalty rate or payment method is spelled out. The payment must be via irreversible wire. The company uses multiple interchangeable names. Legit stores order through Ingram slash KDP, never from the author, and never charge you. The second scam is AI generated, quote, rave reviews. Scammers now email glowing chatbot reviews or, quote, professional coverage of your book to win your trust, then pivot to high pressure pitches for editing, marketing, or big five submissions. Some victims have lost $4,000 to $5,000 for websites or query packages
Oh, that's
that
terrible.
never materialized. Okay, I'm not proposing violence here, but I would like to see these people beaten with a bag of hammers, is all I'm saying. Not violent, gently, gently beaten
Gently,
with
yes.
hammers.
Yeah, it's just to be aware of money goes to the author, not to the author the other way. So anytime you're being asked for money, just do your due
I
diligence,
feel
double,
like
triple
that's
check.
like every scam in the world, right? Like, never send anyone money for something they're promising you up
Yes.
front.
This is why you've got to build a little bit of an author group too, because if you had asked a group of people, a group of authors, even newbie authors, said, "Hey, I got this offer," they'd go, "Yeah, no, that's not a thing." No. So just
You always
you
need
got to have
that
a circle.
suspicious friend in your group. You need the person who goes, "What? They said what? No. Put it down. No, delete. Block."
You know
Right.
what? Spit it out.
Exactly. You know what's great about this story, from what I understand, is there actually now there are groups that are coming on behind this scam and helping offer an opportunity to try and get that money back from the scammer. And of course, those offers are scams themselves.
Right, exactly.
Absolutely.
It's the old insurance play, right? Like,
Exactly. It's amazing.
nice book you got there. It'd be a shame if something happened to it. I think the general rule of thumb, honestly, and it's sad to say, but I mean, in this business in particular, if someone offers you something in exchange for money, it's probably going to be a scam. And unless you know, there's a caveat to that, of course, But, you know, that's why there's things like Draft Digital's model of charging like a percentage of your royalty, no overhead costs. That's been working great. I actually went and kind of investigated all the other little aggregate platforms the other day, and they all charge fees for a certain number of books, you know, for distribution, but you get 100% of the royalty. I'm going to just say I mean, I love some of these folks, and I hate that they're going to hear this and get mad at me. That
Yeah.
feels scammy to me too, though, because
Yeah.
I feel like, why should I pay you, you know, sometimes as much as, you know, for me, it would be like $100 a month minimum to in order to distribute the books that I have through those services. So I don't know.
I guess it's
Maybe.
more for people who aren't interested in taking the time to figure it out themselves or
I
aren't
mean, honestly,
that
that
great
is
with it.
cheaper
Yeah.
on the long haul than the 10% royalty share.
Yeah.
But I don't know. It just to me, it kind of, I don't know. I get
Well,
the heebie-jeebies about it. I'm
it's
sorry,
too
guys. I'm sorry,
close
the
to a scam, I think.
aggregators.
And I don't know. I think I learned from fairy tales at a very young age that all magic has a price. And
Of
so
course, yeah.
if it's too good to be true, it probably is.
I think
And
that's a good way to look at that. I like that. All
yeah.
magic has a. I'm going to steal that and offer you no credit for that
I mean, I
whatsoever.
think it was Hans Christian Andersen that said it, or someone. I don't know. I'm just saying that I learned that at a very young age, and it has proven to be true
Yeah,
over and over
I
and
think
over
that's
again.
wise. It's that whole thing. If it sounds too good to be true, my father, my actually did not meet until I was like 38 years old. Turned out he was an author too, and he had been paying this service
Yeah.
to print his books and everything. And it was a somewhat legitimate service, and a lot, but he spent a lot of money and got nothing out of it except a, you know, a trunk full of books, you know.
Right,
And
yeah.
I just remember at that time, like that soured me on that whole thing and made me want to be an advocate against those services, which is what I've more or less become. All right, final story. Audible rolls out AI narration technology for publishers, preps for AI translation. I'm excited about this, actually. Audible has jumped into AI audio production. The company is now offering publishers a full service pipeline to create audiobooks with synthetic voices. Choosing from 100 plus English, Spanish, French, and Italian options, updated as the tech improves. Machine translation is also on deck for 2025. A beta will let select publishers auto-translate manuscripts or finished audiobooks into the four languages with optional human linguist review or even, quote, speech-to-speech that keeps the original narrator's voice. That is very cool and something I've been really kind of hoping for ever since this whole AI wave of
Yeah, I
audio
think
started.
they were the last holdout, kind of after
But that it
11
seems like
miles.
what they're
And
doing, I think
yeah.
the reason they held out is because of the language option here, because no one else is really offering that yet. And
Oh, interesting.
that's what makes this exciting. Here's something, if I do not know this, so I'm gonna share it. As usual, I'm gonna make myself look like a moron so that you don't have to.
Thank you, Kevin. We appreciate it.
I had agreed to let Amazon do all of the books th that I had that were not already in audio as AI audio, and it kept sending me the notices to say they were there. But what I didn't notice was each one said, you know, awaits your approval. And
Sure.
so all this time I've been thinking they were available for sale, and I'm not going to say how much time, but it was a lengthy period of time, and they
Embarrassing
haven't.
amount of time.
So I've now approved all those. They've all gone live.
How well is that doing? Because I'm not a big fan of the AI narration for one.
Yeah.
I have a lot of good friends or people that I really love that are narrators, and it feels like I'm turning on them. But the other part of it too is it always feels to me like a robo voice. Do you when you hear those back, are you satisfied with what that sounds like?
They're getting more and more satisfactory each time. So what they've been doing, what Amazon's been doing. Now I've had AI audio on Apple and a couple other platforms for a long while, and it actually sounds pretty good. And then they periodically improve them. What Amazon's been doing is they'll improve it and then alert you, hey, the voice has been improved. So, you know, I think they're actually telling me I have to go reapprove the book. I'm not sure, but
Right.
they improve that voice, and it each time I hear the samples, it's sounding better and better. So they are kind of upscaling this as they go.
Right.
So I'm excited about that. I'm excited about I would love the translations. I want them to extend this further. I want to be able to push a button and translate the ebook and the maybe even the file for the print book. I want, you
I
know.
saw that we had, I'm in a number of different little writers groups, and there's a guy that is doing, he does sort of testimonial ads for his own material. And not only can some of these AI programs take what he said on camera, but they can, and sweeten it up a bit because he stammers around, but they can translate it into another language and change it to make it look as though he's speaking that
Yeah,
language,
I've seen that.
which is insane.
Yeah, that's
Yeah.
crazy.
I mean, he
Yeah,
looks
well,
fluent in German. He's yelling the whole
reality.
time, but it's German, so yeah.
Yeah, reality was nice while we knew it.
How do you even know
So,
that they're saying what you want them to say, though? God, I
yeah, you
am
have no idea.
paranoid for them.
Then you have to
How
ask GPT what's being said.
that's what
How do
I
I know
do.
that that knows what it's talking
It
about?
does, because I don't know if I told you. So when I got the Bulgarian
For
cover
now,
of
that's
Heavy
what
Are
it
the
does.
Stones sent to us, I'm like, that does not look like my book. So I had ChatGPT say, I said, what does it say? And it was a James Patterson book. So I'm like,
Nice.
you gave us the wrong cover. This is not her.
So,
It's like,
by the
oh,
way,
wow.
Google Translate, you can use your camera to translate written text into English is a good check for things like that. I would run that over
Right.
every
This
foreign
is how
translate.
they get you, though, right? They
That's
are
yeah.
accurate at first, and then they get everyone using these tools. And
Jenna,
then they
Jenna.
pull a good old switcheroo, and
Oh.
suddenly we are all living
Listen.
in a
In
robot.
1984.
Yeah, we're
Jenna,
being pulled into
loosen the
a
tinfoil cap a little, okay? It's squeezing
robot.
some stuff off up there.
I'm just saying,
Come
that's
out
how
of
it
your bunker.
happens.
Come be
That's
with us out here in the sunshine.
How it happens. That's how they get you.
Well, speaking of how they get you, that is the news for this conspiracy-filled
All right.
episode. So.
Fantastic.
Hey, this is Kevin Tomlinson. It seems to me like you might need a little help. Maybe hand off all that stuff that's keeping you from writing. At Author Anchor, we connect authors with skilled, affordable virtual assistants trained specifically for the publishing world. Your personal VA handles everything from book production to marketing and social media, freeing you up to focus on what matters most, your writing. Book a discovery call today and we'll find that perfect VA for you. Plus, mention the Writers Inc. podcast and you'll get $50 off your first month. Visit authoranchor.com and get matched with your personal VA so you can just write.
So up this week, it's Anthony Horowitz, a best-selling author of over 50 books, including the recent Marble Hall Murders. His teen spy series, Alex Rider, has sold over 21 million copies. His books have been made into TV and film series, and he's been commissioned to write Sherlock Holmes and James Bond novels. He's one of the UK's most successful and prolific authors and is a master of writing novels. Here he is, Anthony Horowitz.
Anthony, welcome to Writers Inc. We love talking about origins, how people start out. A lot of writers listen to this show. So you wanted to be a writer since you were 8, and I'm just looking for what that inciting incident that helped create Anthony the writer, and was it the murder of Benjamin the Stuffed Monkey?
Poor Benjamin, how can you bring him up? Torn to pieces by my dog. No, that actually should have had some kind of sort of some traumatic effect on me that would have sent me into crime writing, but it wasn't that really. It was a series of events being at a particularly vile school. We British, as I'm sure you know, had a thing that if you were rich enough, you could send your children to a school that would destroy them for life. And I was sent to a place called Orley Farm in North London, where I was bitterly unhappy. And from 8, 9, 10, I was suffering at the school. I'd turned up there, just on the age of 8. And I had no friends. The teachers were vicious and thought I was useless and drummed that into me. So I had any sense of self-confidence taken away from me. And I was told over and over again that I would never amount to anything. And if you want the sort of the triggering incident that changed my life, well, first of all, it was discovering the school library and starting to read books there. Not big, clever books, nothing serious. Tintin was my first great love. And as you may know, Tintin is not a detective. He is actually a writer, a journalist. And I thought he seemed to be having a pretty nice life, and it might be quite fun if I was a writer too. And at the same time, reading books, I absorbed the stories and then began to tell stories in the school dormitory. We would sleep 8 kids to a room or 10 kids to a room. All the children there were miserable and scared and lonely. And my stories went down well. And I started to make friends as a result of them. And that persuaded me that my teachers were wrong, that I did have at least one talent. That talent was writing. I loved it. And that's what I would do for the rest of my life.
It is funny how creativity often comes, I don't want to say from a dark place, but it comes from a place that we don't love. Like yours is coming from pain or loneliness or disappointment or disapproval. And somehow that negativity turned into something beautiful. And I don't know if that's how art is always created, but it seems to really follow that pattern.
Well, there are, of course, many writers who talk about an unhappy childhood, and they talk about it as the fuel, as it were, that is still burning within them and driving them forward. My own feeling has always been that storytelling and reading and the world of the imagination has been the lifeline that has run through every year of my existence. And I still, even now, all these years later, still cling to that, to fountain pens, to the panoply of being a writer and the whole world of creativity, just to keep me going.
No, I hear that entirely. Marble Hall Murders is a third adventure with Susan and Atticus. These are delightful stories. The characters couldn't be any more different, especially because one's alive and the other one might be imaginary. The detective, Punt, might be in her head, might be a ghost, might be magical. I'm not entirely sure yet. How much fun is it writing characters like these?
Enormous fun. I've really enjoyed writing Susan Ryland because she's the first main character who is female that I have written. And I have really found a lot of positivity and strength into imagining myself, you know, in her head. And I like her a lot. I like the fact that she's not a detective. And I feel I know her very well now, particularly after 3 books with a 3rd TV series on its way too. And Atticus Punt, I've always been a great admirer of the golden age of murder mystery. From Agatha Christie to Dorothy L. Sayers, Nagayo Marsh, the whole club of them. I mean, you know, and all the wonderful detectives that they created. And Atticus Punt obviously owes something to Poirot, but also to Sherlock Holmes and to many other detectives, actually, that I've read over the years. And I get a lot of fun out of writing him too. You know, I keep thinking about publishing his Landscape of Criminal Investigation, this book that he's been working on for as long as I've known him. One day, maybe it'll see the light of day.
That's so meta. That'd be fantastic. That would be really fun. And you mentioned the idea of switching to, so this is the first female character you've written. Not first female, I mean, first lead, I suppose.
Yes.
Some have said that you fashioned this after Jill, your wife, or did you fashion it after somebody? And I guess I'm asking this because I know that there is quite a bit of conversation right now in the writer's world about males writing female characters and vice versa. But I do find I enjoy, your female character as if written by a woman. So.
Well, first of all, Dick, let me say that I am very nervous of that argument that says the writers should only write about their own gender, their own race, their own ethnicity, their own sort of people like them, because that is really the end of creativity. That is death to writing. And so I shy away from the thought that I should for some reason not, you know, should be punished or should be judged for writing about a woman. The whole job of writing, you know, I write about murderers. I've never killed anybody. So the whole job of writing is to imagine yourself into the heads of people unlike yourself. I am very fortunate in that I am surrounded by very, very clever and powerful women, of whom my wife, Jill Green, who is my producer and makes all my TV shows, including Marble Hall Murders, is one. But then there's Suzanne Simpson, who works at Masterpiece in America and makes the TV shows. Eve Gutierrez, another producer, and so on and so on. And so I have, and my editor, Selena Walker, at our Penguin Random House. I am very fortunate that the women control my life and I can learn from them. Susan was based on all of them to a certain extent, but also she began life with an editor who I worked with at Orion Books some years ago called Susan Lamb, who was one of the great editors, well-known throughout London. And the clue is in her name, Lamb. You probably don't know it, but a Ryland is a breed of lamb.
Right.
Susan Ryland is a character that I created are thinking of her. But as I say, I don't tend to take a single person and put them into my books. I think that is counterproductive often. I am creating, not imitating. So I'll use bits and pieces of lots of different people in to make up one person.
No, and I agree entirely. I mean, for one of my main characters is a 6'7" French Canadian who can turn into a werewolf. So no, I'm not any of those things. So I can entirely understand when, you know, we create these. And it's a bit of fun to sort of put yourself in the head of somebody else. It's sort of a bit of freedom to be able to put yourself in the head of another character.
Well, I just think all I was referring to was the sense of fear that some writers now live in. And that is something that I feel that we writers, whether it's werewolves or women or whatever, need to be on our guard against.
Yeah. Now, in this new book, Marble Heart Murders, you once again put Suze in grave danger as an editor. You know, book editors often face, you know, a death on a daily basis. Can you give us a little taste of this book?
Well, certainly. I mean, in the third book, Susan has come back to London. Her sort of time in Crete has come to an end, and she's now looking for a job, and she rather reluctantly accepts one, working with a young writer called Elliot Crace, who is doing a continuation novel. That is to say, you know, the original writer, Alan Conway, is dead, and Elliot has been chosen by a publisher to write a new Atticus Punt book. He is young, he is troubled, he has all sorts of issues, but he is also the great grandson of perhaps the most famous children's writer who ever lived, a lady called Miriam Crace, and he believes that she was murdered, and in the tradition and the spirit of these books, he has concealed the identity of her killer inside the book he is writing, which of course puts him in danger and Susan too.
That's fantastic. As I mentioned earlier, and I've said that Writers Inc., we have a lot of writers and wannabe writers who listen to this. So I'd love to get to some crafts things from you, some suggestions even. Like, for example, maybe it's kind of a bit random, but are there any things that you would recommend? Like, for example, years ago, somebody recommended to me wrist braces, which I never would have thought of. But are there any items that you use daily in your writing that you would suggest to other writers?
I'm always very leery about recommending almost anything to writers, because one of the joys of being a writer is that we're all different. We all find different ways of inspiring ourselves. There are no rules in our world. What will make a bestseller? Nobody has any idea until it is a bestseller. And in terms of you know, the things that help me, I can talk about that. They are, for example, green tea in very large quantities, or white tea, which are both very good for me. A dog. I think that the best thing a writer can have is a dog. All my best ideas come when I'm out with Chase, my black Labrador, walking in the fields. And I think exercise and fresh air is also an enormous part of what I recommend for myself, and it certainly seems to have worked for me. I am very, very careful about my environment. Everything I look at at the moment, even as I speak to you, is in some ways connected to my work. There is nothing in this room that doesn't bring me back to my thinking about the book that is at hand. Again, that is what I do. And above all, I think the best thing I can recommend to a writer, again, speaking to myself, is trying to avoid anything that is routine. I have nothing that I use all the time. I don't have a special pen, a special pad. I don't do words, you know, 1,000 words by lunchtime, or you know, work 3 hours every day, or 6 hours a day, or 30 hours a week, or whatever. I try to make every single day as different as it is possible to be, given that actually most of my work is spent sitting where I'm sitting right now in this room, talking to you. I've always said that the only difference between a successful writer and a less successful writer is that the room gets a bit bigger. Otherwise, we're all just doing the same thing.
That's great. And I love that advice. Get a dog.
That's
fantastic.
You know, I was trying to work out the plot for Marble Hall Murders, and I had absolutely no ideas. I had a terrible deadline because it was wanted in time to adapt for television to start shooting. And I was really nervous about, you know, where is this idea going to come from? I often ask myself, where do ideas begin? How is it that writers, you know, never seem to dry up? In your case, it's werewolves and it's sci-fi and it's fantasy. In my case, it's murder and it's mystery and it's sort of twisty, surprising stories. And, you know, I had no idea at all. And there's always this terrible fear in my head. Is it over? Has whatever this magic what it has this magic, whatever it may be, come to an end. So then I go up with my dog Chase, and we're in the middle of the most beautiful fields in Suffolk, one of the most attractive parts of the United Kingdom. And I'm just walking down, and just suddenly out of nowhere, I know what this book is going to be about. The theme of it, the sort of this world of actually what it's about largely is famous families. What is it like to be the grandson or the granddaughter of the most famous writer in the world? What does it do for you? You know, and I have worked with literary estates. That's what I'm talking about, literary right. estates. And I suddenly thought, gosh, that's an interesting sort of subject. I've worked with the Dahl estate, the Tintin estate, the Agatha Christie estate, the Doyle estate. They've all been fabulous, by the way, so I'm not criticizing any of them. But nonetheless, I sometimes think to myself, wow, you know, it must be awful in a way if your great-grandmother was the most loved person on the planet for writing all these books and you knew she was a horrible, mean old so-and-so. You know, what does that do to you? So that was how the book began.
Now, is Chase a plotter or does Chase, is Chase a discovery writer with you?
Like his name, he is a fast chaser of balls and sticks and anything else that is thrown for him.
Right.
And he is a constant companion. You know, that's again, writing is such a lonely business and it's great to have something in the room that loves you.
Right, yeah. Do you find yourself somebody who plans out the books quite a bit? Do you know from chapter to chapter to chapter, or are you more someone who is what some people call a pantser?
My own belief is that it is best to leave room to be surprised. If you want to surprise your readers, it is a great idea to surprise yourself. So the answer to your question is that before I start writing a book, a murder mystery is different to, shall we say, an Alex Rider book, because a murder mystery does require much, much more plotting and thinking to, you know, to seed all the clues, to get all the red herrings in place, to work out, you know, the line of the investigation and all the rest of it. But I would have said that even in a sort of a murder mystery book, which will have maybe 30 pages of notes before I write a word of the book, and so everything, right. everything more or less planned, that still leaves within that everything, maybe 20-30% where I can go off in a completely different direction, surprise myself, and therefore hopefully surprise the reader.
Now, do you use beta readers? Is that something you still use? You've been doing this for a good number of years.
Do I use what is?
Beta readers? Early readers who take a look at your
stuff? Oh, I see. That's right. I wasn't aware. I hadn't heard that expression before. Nobody ever reads my books until they're finished. That's the first thing to say. I think it is one of the greatest, you know, I say I don't want to give advice to other writers and I don't. I'm only saying what I believe for myself. But I've always worried that if I start showing my work before it is finished to other people, it is going to be utterly destructive and negative to the experience of writing. Because one of two things will happen. They'll either... They might really dislike the book and start criticizing it, and that will undermine my self confidence. Or they might say they love it, which will do the same. Because how do I know they're telling the truth? Are they just being kind to me? And should I believe them? You know, the only voice I think I want to listen to when I'm writing is my own. I know at heart when a book is working or not. And yeah, occasionally I'll talk to my wife, Jill Green, but that's different because she is my producer. You know, I work for her, she pays my salary. So it's not uncommon for us to have discussions about my work. In fact, it's how we both earn our livings. But by and large, I'll keep it very vague, very general. I never show her anything, really, not of my novels.
Right. Do you find when you're, again, a kind of a process question, are you somebody who edits every day? Do you sit down and think, oh, I'm going to edit some of the stuff we did yesterday? Or do you plow through to the end of the book and then edit?
A bit of both. I have a sort of a system which I find works for me quite often, is to write, shall we say, 30, 40, 50,000 words of a book, which might be, shall we say, 90 or 100,000. So I write about half of it. And then I might go back to the beginning and write it again and keep going to 80,000 words. And then I might go back to the beginning again and get right to the end of it. So it's, if you like, sort of a circular rewriting process. But I am a great believer of forward flow, of not getting bogged down and of not getting stuck on rewriting and trying to make everything better, but to keep moving forward and rushing to the end. When I get to the end, incidentally, of course it isn't the end, because then I'll probably go back and rewrite the whole thing again, and then it goes to my editor and they'll give me notes, and there's another rewriting process that goes on there. So I would guess that by the time anybody reads a book of mine, it's probably had about four drafts.
Right. And when you say rewrite the whole thing, you're saying that it's the same story, you're just making it
Oh, no, by
better.
rewriting, I would have said that everything that goes down on the page is, I would have said that of what, I would have said that about 80% of what I write will end up in the finished book. Because I'm thinking very hard about what I'm doing, and of course you finish a paragraph and you look at it and you think, actually that sounds a bit clunky, or there's a better word I could use here, or do I even need this paragraph? Does that joke work? So it's a sort of self-editing going on endlessly. But that's first draft still. So in a sense, when I'm writing the first draft, I'm expecting my first draft to be 80% there.
Yeah. What about character names? I can't stand coming up with character names.
I love character names. I mean, it's a difficult... Funny enough, I was doing that this morning. Now, where's my notebook? If I could find my notebook, which is now not going to be in front of me, now it's over there on the other side of the room. But I was going through names of my characters, and I was changing them as I went.
Right.
Here we go. Now, Deborah Morgan, I've just created. She's a housekeeper. Her husband, Harry Morgan, who was a chauffeur. And this is set in the world of film. So the director is going to be called Cy Truman. And I don't know why I came up with that name, Cy Truman, but I sort of somehow feel I already know him a little bit. You know, you've got to remember that when you meet somebody for the first time at a dinner party or at a party or in a social or work context, the first thing you often learn about somebody is their name. So, for example, before we began talking, I knew that your name is Dick Whitebrow. And that already, you know, even before we begin talking, that gives me a certain image, an idea of what you might be like. Now, it may turn out to be very different to what I imagined, but nonetheless, the name is your first signpost to the character, that name, Harry Morgan. I mean, that tells me that he's going to be, you know, he's English. He's probably quite middle to lower class. He's a chauffeur, so that also says a little bit more about him. And just by giving him a name, I can begin to imagine him. Without the name, it's a blank page. There's nothing to put anything on.
That's funny, because I go the other way. I should try your direction, see how it goes, because I'll often come up with the character and I'll start writing this person. Every now and then I put a placeholder in, which is a huge mistake, because now I've assigned that placeholder, the character name, and I can't get rid of it now. And sometimes it is not fitting, so I need to come up.
I was changing names in Marble Hall Murders to the very, very end. I mean, because it was a complicated book with two sets of characters who double and sort of appear as each other, as it were. You know, the 1955 characters in the book inside the book are inspired by modern characters. And I was getting very confused as to who was who. And I realized this was down to the names. For some reason, that book, I don't know why it was, but it ended up with every single name, and it began with E. There was an Edward, there was an Elliot, there was an Eric, there was a go on and so on and so on. And it was just, you know, why are you doing this, Anthony? Come on, change these names, make sure that everybody is delineated. It's why, you know, the oldest thing in the book, the oldest thing in sort of writing classes, don't have two characters with the same name in the same book. That never happens. Two Edwards, and you cause problems for yourself.
Right. Yep. No. Exactly. Now, and you mentioned you've written in the James Bond world, Sherlock Holmes world. You've done kid novels, mysteries, television. How do you get your head into that particular universe? You know, because they're so diverse, so different types. How do you put your, like, now I'm going to sit down and I write Susan in Atticus. Is there a process you have, or you put on a certain hat? I mean, I know that sounds goofy, but how do you go about that?
Well, it's not far off from putting on a different hat. When I'm writing a Sherlock Holmes book or a Bond novel, I start by remembering that these are writers who are much, much better than me. You know, Doyle was a genius, so was Ian Fleming. They were remarkable. They were originators, and they had a very, very specific style, a way of writing. And, you know, there's a reason why these books are still loved all over the world, and it's to do with this sort of the genius of their inspiration. Therefore, when I come to write those books, my job is, first of all, to raise my game, to write as well as I can, to write better than I write, because I'm not as good a writer as they are. But the second thing is to absorb everything that they do. So I start by reading. I read all 14 James Bond books. I read all the Sherlock Holmes short stories and the novels as well. And as I wrote, I was underlining things and just observing the tropes and the tropes that these people have, the traits and the tropes, I should say. And then obeying their rules. You know, what they do, I do. So I'll give you a very simple example. When I came to write Sherlock Holmes, my first thought was, should Holmes have a girlfriend? Should there be a love interest in it? Modern novels generally do well to have a sort of, you know, some kind of romance bubbling under the surface. But then, of course, you read A Scandal in Bohemia, and it's Doyle writes, for Sherlock Holmes, there was only ever Irene Adler. So that's the instructions from the top. That's the guy who invented this. So don't go messing with it. Don't bring a girlfriend. Do what he said. And in everything that is in all those books, that was what I was always thinking of. Would the original writer have done this? Would they have liked it? Would they have approved? And above all, I think the job is, writing is a lot about ego. It's a lot about presenting yourself, your ideas, your cleverness, your personality. But in writing a continuation novel of somebody else, it's all about hiding yourself, making yourself invisible. It is not your book, or it is half your book, but it's half theirs.
It's almost like you're writing with that other author sitting next to you, looking over your shoulder.
I felt exactly that. And in fact, when I was writing the books, I bought, at some expense, I must say, a signed James Bond book by Ian Fleming. And I also managed to find a secondhand book with a signature by R. Conan Doyle. And just knowing that those two writers had at one time in their life, for 5 seconds, touched that piece of paper, and now it was on the desk with me, gave them a sort of a spiritual presence, which, as you say so correctly, was as if they were standing watching over my work.
That's fantastic. You've been writing at least publishing since the 80s. Do you still have those, like you mentioned a moment ago about having self-doubt, and that's just something that runs through writers old and new. But do you, while you're writing a story, are there moments, does this happen for every story, that you're writing something and you're like, this isn't any good. What am I doing? I don't know how to do this. Do you still have that self-doubt while writing a particular story?
I have it at certain times. It's sort of a roller coaster of writing a book for me, which is that right now, for example, I'm trying to put the plot together for the sixth Hawthorne novel, and I'm worrying that the plot isn't coming and it's going to be hopeless and it's useless and I won't be able to write it and it'll be no good. Once the plot is in place, however, and I'm hopeful that it will happen quite soon, in fact, it had better. Once I start writing it, I will be 100% confident. In fact, the more I write of it, the more convinced I will be that it is probably the greatest book since the Bible. Then I'll get to the end and I'll write the end and I will take a day off. And on that day, I will begin to think, God, is that book any good? It is the worst book ever written. It is hopeless. And I will stay in that state of mind pretty much until the book is published, and then when the reviews come in and when the sales figures come in and such, and then never, this was the greatest book, no one ever says that. They might say it was okay, it was good, it was very good, but it will, you know, it'll fall in somewhere between that sort of, you know, okay to sort of great, and then it's on to the next one, but that one then has been judged. So yeah, my emotions change as I'm writing. But in the actual course of writing, when I'm sitting down writing a page of the book, I am writing with the belief that it is genius.
Great. That is fantastic. That is actually fantastic advice, because the insecurities can really, I think, seize people up, especially new writers.
I meet many young writers who are new writers who are writing and rewriting and rewriting, trying to make it better and better. And to them, I always say, look, your book is never going to be perfect. It's absurd, and you can't make it perfect. And actually, it doesn't need to be perfect, because you and I know perfectly well, Dick, that that there are books that are horribly written with really terrible plots and which are hackneyed and dreadful, which sell a billion copies, you know, and which are just incredible. So it's not even about a perfect book being a bestseller. All you can do is get the book out there, get it as good as you think you can do, and then risk it, send it out, get it to be seen. And I always think that urge to rewrite and rewrite is actually just fear of finishing. It's fear of actually presenting the work. And it's nonsense. You just do your best and then get it out.
That's fantastic. All right, let's end on, and you don't love giving out advice, so I'll give you a choice.
I just did. I think I've just been doing nothing.
So let's end on the worst piece of advice, the best piece of advice, either one of those or both. Give me those, and then we can close on that.
The worst piece of advice was from my father, which is not to bother writing, but I would never be a success. It's sad to have to say that my father was so negative to me, but he was not. He was a very strange man and had never been a writer in the family. So that was definitely the worst piece of advice because I did very well. I think the best piece of advice I ever got was from Jill. And again, this is something I see in a lot of young writers. They say, "Look, would you mind looking at my book, Anthony? It's not terribly good, but I'm sure you can help me." Never, ever, ever put yourself down. The world is against you. Critics may be against you. Publishers may be against you. The one person who can never be against you is yourself. Be confident about what you're doing and never be timid or be negative about what you've done. There you go. That was the advice that was given to me, and I think it's good advice.
That is lovely advice. That's fantastic. Anthony Horowitz's new book is Marble Hall Murders, which you can pick up now. Anthony, thank you so much for talking with us.
Been a real pleasure talking to you, Dick. Many thanks.
I was surprised that he's never Anthony's. It was great. I was surprised he doesn't. Not only does it sound like he doesn't use beta readers, this concept was foreign to him entirely. What is this beta reader thing you think of? And I love my beta readers. One of the main things, because I think that you can use them for a lot of different reasons, obviously, but one of them is I think some of them know my series better than I do. And so every now and then I'll get a note from one saying, "This is not how your story goes. This is not consistent with canon." And so I need those people because I don't have a memory. Do you guys, I mean, do you find you use them for different reasons?
I mean, I use my, I call them a street team. So, the first thing they do is help me with the editing, which is great. And then that usually leads to them leaving a review, which I appreciate. But yeah, some of them are super fans. So they will call me, call me on something that I got wrong that I really should have gotten right. So yeah, it does kind of keep you, it's nice. It's nice bowling lane, guardrails is what it is. It's nice to have that
I mean,
group.
I have a small group, but mostly they're like my critique partners. So, I mean, it's not like a wide beta group, but they're people whose opinions I trust. They know me, they know my writing, and they're not afraid to hurt my feelings. So
That's great.
that works out really well. But, I think it just kind of depends. I mean, some people, he, I don't know. I mean, I'm sure at some point, an editor reads, but I mean, at 50 novels, I don't, you know what you're doing at that point. I imagine that like Stephen King probably doesn't have a lot of beta readers at this point.
No. I mean, I liked what he said. The only voice I want to listen to is my own, which is aspirational writing goals, writer goals, I guess. But
Whatever works for you,
yeah,
right?
I used to be more reliant on it. Like I used to more heavily use alpha readers, and now I'm finding I do it less, but I still like my few people who give me
I mean,
good feedback.
let's be clear. Like my beta readers will give me their feedback or whatever, but I'm really only looking for the technical stuff. I'm not out. I don't want their critique on the way the story flowed or
Change
any
the
of that.
story.
Yeah. 'Cause
I think.
everyone's got their take, and everyone thinks that they could do that better. And as soon as they've got a New York Times bestseller, they are welcome to give me that feedback.
Well, I
But
think that's
even
why
then,
I
they
just
don't know
have
what
that.
story you're going for, right? Like,
That small group works for me because, it's important, especially when you're, kind of in that stage of editing and drafting that, like, obviously you can make a mistake and you can forget something and you can, oh yeah, that plot line completely fell off the galaxy. You're right. Those are important, but you definitely don't want to like hand your work over to someone who's going to, take it a completely different direction. Even if you don't listen to him, I think that there is sort of a vulnerable state that you can sometimes find yourself in where you're just like, is this should I do that? And if you have that doubt, maybe it keeps you from seeing a different way forward or a solution that would actually be better and fit your story better. So I do think that you need to be very wary who you give your work to and make sure that you trust them. I
You
think
also
that's
have to set up some. You set up some parameters from the beginning. Here's the stuff I'm looking for. Play within these lines because I do have one. I do have one beta reader, and he's a jerk, and I love him for it. because this guy is like, ah, oh, this part sucks. This is, I didn't understand this. And out of those 30 things he hates, two or three of those, like, you know, he might have a point on a couple of these things, and that's helpful. But the funny part is, he loves the stuff I write. So, yeah, but you say you hate all this stuff.
Somewhere in this
You gotta have a
set,
Steve. Everybody needs a Steve, and
yeah.
so Steve is important to me.
I may actually have Steve. I have a
Right.
Steve on my team who is kind of like that.
Perfect.
I don't know. It
There's a
sounds like
somewhere
his
in this.
son on vacation. He's just like, I'm completely a teenage son. When you get home, he's like, I loved it. And I'm like, really? Because did you see your
Yeah.
face the whole vacation?
This closet behind me
Hilarious.
here, there is a folder somewhere in there. It's a cat folder. It's got a cat kitten on the front of it. And it's got an entire printout of one of my manuscripts, and every single page has multiple color ink, highlights, notes in the margins. And this was from a reader who was not a beta reader, but a reader that I sent a free copy of the book to, and she took it upon herself to get it printed out, handwrite a whole bunch of corrections, and send them back to me. And it
Amazing.
was every single correction, though, was along the lines of what you'd learn in like freshman English class. Like,
Right,
she
yeah.
didn't like me using contractions, for example. You know, never use
Yep.
contractions. Like,
There's nothing like people who are confidently wrong.
Never start a
no.
sentence with because. Okay.
Now, Kevin, you mentioned having your kitty folder there
Yeah.
in your office, and Anthony talked about how he sort of decked out his office with various tchotchkes and things that gets him in the writing mood. And I've known writers that have like mood
Yeah.
boards, and they have
Yeah.
tokens, and they have gifts and fan art. And my office is, I'm lucky if there's no dirty dishes in the air. It's chaosy. Do you guys
Yeah.
set a bit of a scene? Because Jenna, you've got a beautiful sort of setup back behind you on the video. Do you have kind of a bit of a writing sort of scenario, or?
I don't. This is like the most organized that my office is, because it's
Right.
usually on camera. The rest of it's a complete chaos, disaster most of the time, and I don't always write in here. I actually usually write in bed first thing in the morning. So I wake
Right.
up and I have like a tea kettle next to my bed, one of those electric ones, and I hit the switch and I have my green tea and I will write for 30 minutes in bed, because if I don't, the odds of that happening, just some, maybe I'll write during the day or maybe I'll write, but juggling a job and freelance and a husband and a dog, and it's just too much. So I write in
But you have anything that sort of, I mean, like a music, is there a certain music you listen to? So
bed.
you don't sort of wrap yourself in a writing world. That's interesting, right?
Yeah, we had Symphony Paleo on a while ago, and she talked about writing before bed when she was half asleep, because that sort of dream
Sure.
state.
Yeah.
And I
I
can't
have
do
narcolepsy, so yeah.
that. But I thought, when I was trying to figure out where I can consistently fit writing in, and I thought, let's try in the morning. And so before I'm even really awake, I just grab my laptop and I just sort of nestle in the pillows
I actually think that's a really cool
and
writing
write.
ritual. Not one I want to replicate, but I mean that's very cool. That's the first thing Jenna does. Wake up, make some green tea, right there in bed,
Yeah, and I
starts
just,
writing.
yeah, it's a new thing. I've been doing it for about just a couple months, but I had to. My life just sort of got really busy, and I was like, I have to schedule writing time. And that was the only time in my day where I can consistently guarantee I can be at my computer and writing.
Yeah.
So that's what I do. It's working out really well. I've made a lot of progress, so I'm pleased with it. I'm gonna keep doing it.
Yeah. I am also, that's better than me. I'm absolute chaos. I don't write the same place. I don't write the same time. I have no rituals and no stuff. the only thing that I usually will listen to white noise. That's my only
Yeah. All
one thing
right.
I will do. But yeah,
Yeah.
that's it.
And sometimes thrash metal when she has to be mean to her
Oh, when I have
character.
to be mean to my characters, I will listen to thrash metal. Yes.
That's cool, though. That's pretty funny.
Kevin, do you set it up? You put on your Dan Cutler, pajamas and
I do.
start. Do you?
Pull those
Right.
on. They're a little tight for me these days, but
Right.
I make it work. But no, yeah, I'm pretentious as F basically. I mean, I'm
Right.
surrounded by
I love it.
accoutrement. Like if you were to see the screen, and most people are listening, but I've got like typewriters and old writing desks and old leather-bound journals and things. And I surround myself in the kind of environment that, I think of it as that sort of quintessential writer's environment. I think Hemingway would be right at home in this space. However, I'm a neat freak, so all my stuff is always organized and very, very neat and put in little columns and stuff. So I'm not a messy person or a messy thinker, but I like planned messiness. If you look around my office, there's like little vignettes of supposedly this was a random placement, but it's
This
actually
could
meticulously
be
placed.
messy
Oh, I
in
love
another
that.
life.
Yeah.
Yeah,
This
my
could be a
husband's
writing
like that.
boom. There's a journal on the writing desk behind me that's
I
askew.
want to come there now because my
Oh,
husband is
yeah.
like that, and I move stuff just to
You're a hair musser,
watch him
aren't
walk
you?
by and like do a double take and have to put it back. It cracks me up
Perfect.
every
Yeah, yeah,
time.
yeah. That's a good way to cause me to have a stroke, actually, if that's what you're looking to do.
My husband constantly, I just, set things down and like, an edge of like a book will hang off the counter and he's just constantly like, just why can't you just put it straight? Why can't you just put it straight? And I'm like,
Kara does that with her laptop. She'll put her laptop like
yeah, I
right on
do
the
the
edge
same
of the
thing.
bed where
Yeah.
it's like it's hanging
It's
over.
fine.
It's fine.
It's I don't
What's the
even know
matter with you people?
where to put it.
So do you stress out about the names as much as Anthony does? Because it sounds like he actually gets to the point where he's changing names of characters throughout the book. I don't like names. Names bug me. I just hate. And the problem that I have, like I mentioned to him, is there's times where I gotta come up with another name, and I'll put in a placeholder, and then I'll just after a while it just becomes that placeholder, and it's the worst.
Yeah.
It's not a good plan
I
because I
mean, I'll
can't change it
change
after
it.
putting it.
I'm never married to names. I try to create my characters first. So I try to pick
Yeah.
names that sort of like fit the vibe, but sometimes it just doesn't
Wow, that's
work.
great.
Or I'll get feedback that as a reader was reading, it was, oh, the names confused me. So like I actually have a character now that I'm considering changing, because it's just, they both end with E, and so it gets a little messy.
Yeah.
So I'll probably change her name, because she's more of a minor character, and so it doesn't really bother me. I
Yeah.
just
Yeah, I'm
names.
just chaotic with names too, whatever. And then sometimes I change them late, like in the editing draft when I'm almost done. I'm like, those names are too similar and I'll just change them.
Yeah. Or they just don't fit. I don't like them anymore.
Yeah.
Or they're terrible to type. I've done that before while drafting. Like, I'm just like, I am so sick of typing this name. If I never see this
I
name
have had that happen, but I stick with it. But yeah, no, and I'm actually really good with
out of
naming. I
there.
mean, it just I have a whole I don't I collect names as I go. As I encounter people out in the wild, I'll kind of remember that name. Like that's a good one. Or this kind of, and I like to recombine names.
Oh, I do that
So
too. Sometimes with people I know, I'll combine their names. Yeah.
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 Yeah. So yeah.
Yeah.
Well, hey, Christine, we should probably wrap up. What's
We should.
what are we looking at for next week?
So next week, it's New York Times and USA Today bestselling author Heather Graham. Her first book was with Dell, and since then, she has written over 200 novels and novellas in suspense, historical romance, vampires, time travel, occult, sci-fi, YA, and Christmas. She's been published in approximately 30 languages and has written over 200 novels and has 70 million books in print. So that's coming next week, Heather Graham. If you'd like to be notified as soon as new episodes publish, make sure you go to writersincpodcast.com and sign up now. We'll see you next episode and have a great week of writing.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Writers Inc. Access the show notes and leave a comment at writersincpodcast.com.